This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A paraplegic man in Dayton was pulled over by police and then dragged out of the car. The event prompted activists to protest outside City Hall. We'll get more on this story and about police reform efforts in the city of Dayton from WYSO reporter Mawa Iqbal, who joins us now via Zoom. Mawa, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you. I'm hoping you can take us back to September 30th and tell us about this gentleman and the event that led to these recent protests.
Yeah, so what happened was Clifford Owensby was, he's a resident of West Dayton, which in Dayton is a predominantly Black and Brown community, and he was driving. And he was stopped by police officers because they saw him leaving a suspected drug house. And so in the body cam footage, it shows the police officers asking him to step out of the car. Owensby says that he is unable to because he is paraplegic. And officers essentially, at one point, they said that they didn't really believe him. Like, they asked him, well, if you are paraplegic, how did you get in the car? In the video, you can see the controls on the car that most paraplegic people use when they drive cars. And so it... at this point, Owensby was getting frustrated and said, you know, I would like to speak with a supervisor, like, or a white shirt, as he's heard saying in the video. The officer said, you can get out of the car and then I can bring my supervisor. This escalates for a few more minutes to the point where the officer said that you have two options. You can either cooperate with us or you'll be dragged out. And so police officers then, you know, unbuckle his seatbelt and then pull him out of the car by his hair, throw him onto the ground, and then handcuff him behind his back. His child is in the back seat, so his child was watching it as it all went down. And then the footage ends with Owensby being buckled into the car, still saying, I am paraplegic, I am paraplegic, I am unable to walk. So it's very, very hard to watch.
I can imagine that it's hard to listen to a description about it. So when Mr. Owensby is brought out of the vehicle in such a physical manner, did officers not recognize his handicap?
I'm assuming they must have because he wasn't able to stand, you know, like he was on the ground. But however, I will say that when he was being handcuffed on the ground, one officer did place his knee on his back. So he wasn't really able to move regardless, which is really, really unfortunate. And then as they were taking him to the car, you can see that they were dragging him, like his legs were dragging behind him. So I think I'm hoping at least at this point that officers and anyone else who was watching was able to see that, okay, this man really cannot walk on his own.
Was Owensby charged with anything?
So he was cited with two charges. One charge was having tinted windows, and then the other was having a child ages 4 to 5 in the back seat, not wearing a seatbelt. But so Owensby has hired an attorney, and they said they're filing a civil suit.
So naturally, this led to some challenges at City Hall. Some people showed up, some advocates on Owensby's behalf were protesting, and I believe that we have some sound that you provided us, Mawa. Josh, can we hear that?
And we expected the response.
I should have put out the truth then. Everybody deserves to see the rest of that video and everything that happened in the back of that cruiser.
Please.
I'm out of here.
And Mawa, that was Clifford Owensby talking. I believe he was referencing the dash cam video or the body cam footage. I'm sorry, Mawa. We just brought your mic back up. Was that Mr. Owensby talking about the dash cam or the body cam footage?
Yes, that was him. He was, so basically for context, that was during the city commission meeting Wednesday morning. And so, you know, several leaders from the Dayton community, activists, clergymen, and prominent leaders within the Black community came out and wanted to basically stage a demonstration in solidarity with Clifford. So there was one half of the demonstration was outside City Hall during the meeting. And, you know, people were speaking, demanding for change, expressing outrage, while the other half of the demonstrators were inside giving public comment. And so the lead up to this situation was essentially there were multiple people who had given public comment, you know, expressing their outrage, expressing, you know, how could the city that says that, you know, they're all about Black Lives Matter and all about police reform have something like this happen, you know, on their watch. And so the comment before the clip that we just heard There was a person who knew Owensby personally, and, you know, he was talking, he was, you know, expressing his frustration, and then his 3 minutes were up. And so once his 3 minutes were up, the mayor said, okay, you know, your 3 minutes are up, sir, you can leave now. The man says, you know, like, I'm not going to leave, like, I can talk all day. And this escalates for a few minutes to the point where the situation in the room got really tense. I wasn't in the room personally. My fellow reporter, Alejandro Figueroa, was inside while I was outside. But he describes it as being very, very tense. The guards in the perimeter of the room, like he saw their hands go on their belts, you know, presumably on their tasers. They were looking at the man who was speaking and kind of in a stance, like ready to go if something were to happen. So Alejandro describes the scene very tense, and people were very, very upset, and a lot of murmuring going on. And eventually the man does leave, but then after that is when the mayor, Nan Whaley, says, you know, we appreciate all this public comment and we are working really hard to conduct an investigation. We're very saddened by what has happened. And that's when you hear in the clip, Mr. Owensby saying, you know, you don't care. You know, if you really did, you'd show the whole video. And he essentially stormed out afterwards, followed by everyone else who gave the public comment. And that's when they all came out to where I was outside. And So it was a very, very tense situation.
We're talking with WYSO reporter Mawa Iqbal. And before we get into the broader exploration of police reform in the city of Dayton, what's next in this case specifically? Do we know?
As far as we know, so the attorney is filing a civil lawsuit. It's unclear if it's against the city and the police department or just the police department. But the NAACP, like the national chapter, is conducting their own an independent investigation into Mr. Owensby's arrest. And as the city has said, they're also conducting an internal investigation. But activists and demonstrators who were at the demonstration on Wednesday do have a list of demands if you'd like me to read them.
Yes, please.
Okay. So basically the first demand is issuing a public apology to Mr. Owensby's family. You know, essentially, you know, for all the distress that they have endured, all officers, the second demand is all officers in the Owensby case be suspended until the investigation is over. The third is an institution outside the city of Dayton conduct an independent and transparent investigation into the officers' use of force, not hired or through the DPD. And then finally, the city of Dayton immediately implement all the changes to the police department on their use of force policy.
Mawa, as part of your reporting on this story and the demonstrations outside the city building during this period this week, you quote a demonstrator named Ari Devine who says, quote, "This takes us back to when we were talking about George Floyd. How many times do I have to tell you that I cannot comply because you are harming me? You are killing me." Of course, George Floyd, a reference to the man killed by police in Minneapolis, an event that sparked nationwide and global racial justice protests last summer. And so here we are on the other side of last summer, and we're seeing incidents like this. But this is after cities like Dayton committed themselves to reforming the way their police departments might operate. Where is the city on police reform?
Yeah, so the city currently right now, so after George Floyd's death, for a little bit of context, the city announced that they were going to have this 5-point police reform plan, basically. And so the plan included creating these 5 working groups, you know, consisting of community members, clergymen, legal representatives, city and police personnel, just a bunch of different people from a bunch of different backgrounds, activists too. And they were to meet a couple times a month to come up with policy recommendations. And each of these groups, each of these 5 groups had a specific focus area. So things like one group was use of force, one group was focusing on recruitment, another group was focusing on oversight. And so altogether, these groups have submitted 142 policy reform recommendations. These are anything from, you know, hiring or making a more committed effort to hire more diverse candidates to outlining, you know, not using a chokehold when arresting somebody. So out of all of these 142 recommendations that have been submitted and accepted, now there is this implementation committee that is working on the long-term implementation of these 142 recommendations. And so about 51 of them, so about like 35% of them are marked as completed or completed ongoing. And something that a lot of the demonstrators who were also people who sat on these working groups, said was, you know, we met for like a year and a half, you know, exchanged like hundreds of thousands of emails and spent hundreds of hours meeting. And we just feel like the city is dragging their feet. You know, they're not working on these recommendations fast enough. Specifically, a couple of members brought up these three use of force recommendations that haven't actually been given a decision yet. And so per the working group's charter, right, so the thing that these members agreed on before they got onto these working groups, the city commission would either accept, deny, or ask for like further information after each policy recommendation was submitted within 30 days of its submission. Specifically, there are three use of force recommendations. You can go on the city website too. They were submitted in March, and and they still haven't actually acted on them. And so these recommendations specifically highlight, you know, adopting a policy that gives officers the purpose of respecting the sanctity of human life, you know, and preserving it. There's another recommendation that says, you know, using all means possible to avoid use of force and to employ de-escalation strategies. There's a third recommendation says adopting core principles of de-escalation, public cooperation. And essentially these three recommendations, what they do is create like a tighter definition or tighter language around de-escalation and use of force to make sure that officers are putting the human sanctity of human life first, right? They're minimizing how much force they can use. And so one demonstrator who was giving public comments said at the demonstration on Wednesday, they said, you know, I've sat on these working groups for like the past year and a half, and I believe that if these recommendations have been acted on instead of, you know, waiting 6 months to act on them, if they've been acted on after the 30 days that we agreed to, this situation with Clifford Owensby would not have happened. Or if it did happen, then the Fraternal Order of the Police representative, the police union representative, wouldn't be able to say, oh, what officers did was lawful, which that is the statement that they released.
We're talking with Mawa Iqbal of WYSO Radio. And I know that your station has had its own challenges with the city of Dayton in conducting interviews about police reform.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny because, you know, funny in a kind of a sad way, but when it comes to interviewing and reporting about police reform within the city of Dayton, of course, I want to talk to people who sit on these groups and activists and community members, but I also would like to talk to city officials. However, I published an article back in March about the recommendation process and how some people felt like, you know, the city was dragging their feet. And they dismissed it as misinformation. They said that it totally mischaracterized the city and the efforts they were doing, and that that's not how people felt. And essentially, as retaliation, they said that any WYSO journalists are not allowed to interview us like audio interviews. So we can't call them. We can't do it in person. We can only send them an email of our questions. And it's interesting because now those same concerns that I published about earlier are coming back up, but in like a bigger way. So it's very interesting time, I will say. But yeah,
that sounds rather unfortunate. I'm wondering, I mean, is the station doing anything to work through that with the city?
Yeah, we so our news director has been emailing the person who handles the communications there and just asking for, because they said that they've adopted a policy back in April following my article that says that the city of Dayton employees are not allowed to conduct audio or in-person interviews with WYSO journalists. And so we're asking through open records law, you know, to provide us like with this policy, like asking like who authorized this, like did you consult any like legal groups when drafting up this policy, like that sort of thing. And so far, we have not gotten an email back from them, but we'll keep our eyes open for that. So,
well, so will we. We'll look forward to catching up with you again on all of this. WYSO reporter Mawa Iqbal, thank you for sharing your reporting with us, and we do hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the weekly news review. Ohio law permits what is called marital rape in some cases, and advocates want to change that. Columbus Dispatch reporter Haley B. Miller joins us to explain. Haley, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, help us understand the definition of this crime, marital rape.
So Ohio has a very convoluted rape law when it comes to spousal rape. It's illegal regardless of whether or not the perpetrator is your spouse, if there's a force or threat of force, or if you're married and you don't live together. But where this exception starts to come in is other parts of the rape statute that say it's illegal to rape someone if the victim is drugged or impaired because of a mental or physical condition, or if the victim is under 13 years old. But in that category, none of that applies if the person is your spouse. And there are other statutes as well regarding sexual battery and like gross sexual imposition, you know, barring other kinds of non-consensual sexual contact, where those crimes are not considered illegal if the perpetrator is your spouse.
According to your reporting, Haley, you cite the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network that shows that 8 in 10 rapes are committed by someone known by the victim, and that a third are carried out by a current or former spouse, boyfriend, or girlfriend. And so with that volume of these crimes being perpetrated by these individuals in victims' lives, what are people saying about the status of Ohio's statute?
Yeah, people feel like Ohio is just really, behind the times when it comes to this. Ohio is certainly not alone. There are other states that have similar exemptions for spouses, similar policies. But, you know, as you noted, the statistics show that, you know, despite the stereotype of a rapist being a stranger who's lurking in a dark alley, you know, more often than not, you know, victims know their perpetrator. And so advocates here are seeing, you know, what they consider a two-tiered system where, you know, if your spouse rapes you, you know, in some cases you may be able to pursue justice, but in some cases not. And it's, it's a confusing system. It leaves, you know, survivors unsure of, you know, whether they're able to pursue charges. And advocates say it's just another example of how, the state isn't supporting survivors and allowing them to pursue justice.
You spoke with State Representative Kristen Boggs, a Columbus Democrat, who said, quote, "I don't think anyone walks down the aisle realizing they're giving up bodily rights of their own." And that's a pretty shocking statement to characterize the statute in Ohio. And so you're talking to a lawmaker. I'm wondering, is there some type of legislation floating around to address this? What prompted this conversation?
So there is a bill sponsored by Boggs and a Republican lawmaker that would essentially close this loophole. Rape would be considered illegal in all circumstances. The spousal exception would not exist. It would also allow spouses to testify against each other in a prosecution regarding these crimes. But this bill has been introduced several times before this session and hasn't gained any momentum. And part of that is because, you know, several years back, prosecutors were, you know, against it, really felt that this could open the door for false allegations, could twist, divorce cases, child custody cases. The Ohio Prosecuting Association has since come around. So, you know, I think lawmakers now are more hopeful that it can pass. But, you know, that was certainly part of the conversation back then. And advocates have said, look, you know, just because this exception, just because this loophole would be closed, doesn't mean that, you know, these cases wouldn't still go through the criminal justice system. And so false allegations, et cetera, would still be weeded out. They just want, you know, these survivors to have the chance to even bring these cases forward.
We're talking with Haley B. Miller, a reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, which serves the Columbus Dispatch, the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Akron Beacon Journal, and other affiliated news organizations across the state. Haley, you just mentioned that the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association has come around on the legislation. I guess that suggests that they opposed this at one time. Do we know why?
Yeah, it goes back to the idea that, you know, they worry that people would use, you know, the law to, you know, falsely accuse someone of rape and divorce cases and child custody cases, and that could, you know, complicate those matters. But, you know, they've since changed their tune on that and, you know, come around to the point that advocates have made, which is, you know, that, you know, the criminal justice system weeds those circumstances out. So because of that, you know, lawmakers are certainly hoping that that helps move the conversation along and maybe persuade some lawmakers who have previously been hesitant to get on board with this.
What do we know about why this type of crime takes place? I know that there are experts who specialize in this type of criminal activity. And, you know, why does this happen so much among people who are known to each other, rather than, as you said at the beginning, this sort of stereotype of a rapist, someone lurking in an alley? It's so rarely the case.
Marital rape, you know, certainly occurs on its own, but is also, you know, an extension of other domestic violence that can occur in the home. And, you know, experts have told me, you know, it's really just another way that perpetrators wield control over their partners. You know, when you think about domestic violence, it's, you know, there's physical abuse, there can be a financial element to it. You know, saying you have to do this, or, you know, you're not going to be financially supported. And then, you know, sex is another way that, you know, these perpetrators wield that control over people. And, you know, there's an attitude, particularly among, you know, perpetrators who are married to their victim, that, you know, we're married, you owe me this, you know, because you said I do. You know, experts have also told me that people will use religion as a way to manipulate their partners into unwanted sex as well. You know, saying that, you know, our religious text says that, you know, you belong to me essentially, and because of that, you have to have sex with me and, you know, engage in sexual conduct with me whenever I want, regardless of what you want.
You include a comment from Rosa Beltre, president and CEO of the Ohio Alliance to End Sexual Violence. And it stuck out to me because, you know, as part of the Me Too movement that has taken place over the last several years, I think our culture has talked a lot more about consent in sexual activity than perhaps ever before. And the quote from Rosa Beltre says, "People have problems accepting the reality that in a relationship, consent continues to be crucial." And that was just really surprising, maybe disturbing to me, that is very clearly an issue based on the statistics. And it seems to be brought on by what you just mentioned, the nature of some of these relationships.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, among some people an attitude, and to an extent, you know, I've heard that, you know, some feel that, you know, Ohio lawmakers have, you know, had this kind of attitude as well, which is part of why the law hasn't been able to change, that, you know, things like this can't happen in the marital bed. They don't happen in a relationship, when in fact they very much do. And, you know, I think, you know, it's just, whether you're married to the person, whether, you know, someone's just your boyfriend or your girlfriend, whether you're engaged, I mean, sex absolutely still must be consensual. And I think there's an idea that among some people that, you know, if you're in a relationship, if you've married someone, then, you know, sex is just automatically consensual all the time, which is very much not the case. It's still, you know, has to be a very active part of the conversation. And,
State Representative Kristen Boggs, the Democrat of Columbus, and State Representative Laura Linnese, Republican of Grove City, as you mentioned earlier, have introduced legislation to eliminate exemptions for sex crimes committed by spouses, and it would also allow people to testify against their spouses regarding those offenses. You also noted that this bill has not advanced since a couple of committee hearings back in the spring. Do we know, or do we have any sense of whether this legislation is still alive or if there's another step for it somewhere down the road?
It's unclear at this point. I believe it's set up to go in front of another committee, but it hasn't been scheduled yet. Representative Lanise made the point to me that there's so much legislation each session that's competing for the attention of lawmakers. And so, you know, it's a matter of trying to get, you know, this in front of them and make it a priority. Democrats held a press conference yesterday to discuss not only this issue, but other legislation that would extend and eliminate the statute of limitations for rape, remove a cap and damages. So there's definitely a push, by Democrats in particular, to advance some of these bills that deal with sexual violence and try to help survivors more easily pursue justice.
Haley B. Miller is with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, serving the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Columbus Dispatch, the Akron Beacon Journal, and other newspapers. Haley, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
There are no providers of abortion in Mason, but city council is looking into a possible ban on that practice, and that plan led to large protests this week. WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez was there. She joins us now via Zoom. Jolene, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Well, take us to Mason. What did the scene look like?
Oh, gosh. So Monday night, there were hundreds of people outside Mason City Hall, more than 100. Most of them were opposed to a proposed ban on abortion. But there were also people there, a few dozen, at least more than two dozen people there, who support the ban on abortion. And again, you mentioned it, but I want to say it again, there are no abortion providers in the city of Mason. But things like this, where smaller municipalities that do not have abortion providers have been outlawing abortion all across the country. There are allegedly now almost 40 cities that have done this. And it's really thought to be part of a much bigger conversation about Roe v. Wade, which the Supreme Court which is being challenged at the Supreme Court later this year.
And we should note that Mason's not the only local city that did this. A similar situation played out in Lebanon. And I think some of the same folks were involved in both of these places.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad that you mentioned that. There is an organization based out of Texas and a man named Mark Dixon. Is part of the organization called Sanctuary City for the Unborn, Cities for the Unborn. And, you know, when he talked to me afterward, I talked to him in Lebanon as well. And he is providing cities sort of these ordinances that have been passed in other cities across the country. It's sort of like a template that cities can use and sort of have a little bit of, I guess, a feeling that maybe it could hold up to legal challenges. And that's, you know, definitely plays a factor in how this is spreading.
You spoke to a resident of Mason that I think expressed some of the confusion about why something like this is taking place. And I may not say your last name correctly, so correct me if I'm wrong, Jolene. Your name is Carrie Ahrensmere?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Close enough.
Yeah, so
it's like, look, we moved to Mason because we wanted to be in a good school district. I did not expect... the direct quote is, I never really thought I would be in a place where we'd have to go to City Hall and protest for abortion rights because City Hall should be taking care of things like making sure the roads are working, recycling is getting picked up. We shouldn't be here fighting for our human rights and our dignity at City Hall. It's just unbelievable. I imagine that her opinion was shared by others on the scene.
Yes, absolutely. That's definitely a feeling. And, you know, and she mentions, so there's a lot at stake here. I guess you could really think of, like, why would a city that doesn't have an abortion provider want to ban abortion? And really, that's twofold. One is the one I mentioned earlier, which is sort of this symbolic and very public way to show like, hey, we want Roe v. Wade to be struck down. We do not support abortion. And also it kind of puts a stopper on any abortion provider coming in the future to set up shop, right? So there's that reason, but there's also, you know, everything's political. And so she points out, Ahrensmeier points out that the mayor, Kathy Grossman, is going to be launching a 2020 state house run. And sort of on this flyer, there's not a lot of information out there about it yet, but there is this flyer that she has been passing around to the mayor. And it basically has sanctuary cities as a bullet point, her support of sanctuary cities for the unborn, that's what they're calling this, as a bullet point for why people should elect her. So it's really, really a political issue as well.
So there are some who believe that the mayor of Mason, Kathy Grossman, who is running for state representative next year, is possibly using this as a political ploy to boost her chances of moving into the state legislature, where issues like this are also often discussed.
Yes, and that was also, you know, some of the accusations that more than one person in Lebanon on that city council had similar, you know, aspirations for higher office. So, I mean, it's really multifaceted. And I'd like to point out, so we have sort of these two ideas, this symbolic stance against Roe v. Wade, and then we have this, like, you know, politics as usual kind of aspect. But I do want to say that for a lot of people there, whether they support the ban or they don't support the ban, you know, it's really personal. I spoke to some people who support the ban who genuinely feel that abortion is murder.
Yeah, you did note in your reporting that there were a lot of Catholic prayers, the Hail Mary being said this week outside of this, in addition to the protests for human rights. So share some of the perspective of those who showed up to support this exploration of a ban on abortion in Mason, Ohio.
Right. So at the Lebanon one and at this one in Mason, people show up and just say, you know, this is murder. This is against God's plan, God's will. And we want to see bans like this all over the country, that they want to see Roe v. Wade overturned. And that has nothing to do with symbolism or politics. That for those people, it's their own sense of morality. But, you know, the other side of the coin is, and this is, it's always really disturbing when we get into it or when these conversations start happening, the women who oppose the bans often talk about having been raped. One situation that just stands out in my mind so clearly is a woman who got up and talked about her own experiences. And she said, "I'm lucky I've only been raped twice." And they sort of use their experience to talk about why abortion should be necessary for people. So, I mean, for the people who are showing up, it's not really about either of these things. It's really about, you know, where they stand on the moral compass.
So where are we on this ordinance? Did it pass? Is it coming back?
Oof. Okay. Complicated, but I'll try to keep it as uncomplicated as I can. So basically, the city of Mason, the elected officials, some of them at least, wanted to pass this issue via emergency, which means that it would go into effect right away and that people would not be able to challenge this through a referendum. And there was a lot of discussion and it looked like it was going to happen. But sort of in a last minute twist, there's a council member who started to suggest, well, maybe the people should decide this issue. But and they put a motion on a table, but that did not pass. However, sort of in a last minute swing, there were enough people who voted against the emergency part of the measure. So now they have to take a look at it again on, I believe it's October 25th. And they're going to look at it again. But this time around, even if it passes, and it does look like it's going to have enough support to pass just on a simple majority, right? But then people can take it to a referendum. And that means people are going to, like, the residents of Mason, if they would like, may be able to challenge this, like, put it on a ballot and have the citizens vote for it. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens here.
Have we heard from individual members of council? I understand that they were quite quiet leading up to this meeting.
Yeah, so I reached out. I called several of them. I called the city hall, but I also found some personal numbers online. I also sent emails out. I couldn't get anybody prior to Monday's meeting. But during the actual meeting, people were very spirited about why they felt the way they felt. And I think there was even if there is a political reasoning behind it, whether anyone on that council is looking for higher office, you know, it was very much discussed as a moral issue by some.
WVXU reporter Jolene Almendarez. Read her reporting at WVXU.org and be sure to listen for it right here on 91.7 FM. Jolene, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Michael.
You got it. And up next, a trip to Monmouth Street in Newport, where the old is mixing with the new, and the search for WEC in Cincinnati. Enquirer food writer Keith Pandolfi will be with us next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We'll wrap up the weekly news review now with Enquirer food writer Keith Pandolfi, who joins us on the phone. Keith, thank you for being with us.
Great being here, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're really glad to have you on. It's been a bit of a heavy news show today, so I'm glad to talk about some food here as we ease into the weekend, so thank you. We're going to do a search for WEC here soon, and this fascination you have with this sandwich and why it's apparently lost its way in Cincinnati. But first, I want you to take us to Monmouth Street in Newport. Now, this is the main street historically that runs through that Campbell County city, and it's beautifully intact still all these years later. A lot of those historic buildings are still there, and I know it well. It's had some fits and starts with, you know, things coming and going. What's the state of Monmouth Street right now for people looking for a good place to eat?
It's pretty great. I think that it is overshadowed a lot by Over the Rhine and Covington, which has so many new restaurants and bars there. Monmouth Street is definitely a little sleepier, but the history of it alone is worth a visit. And as you know, it was used to be kind of the heart of Sin City when Newport was known as that. It's a place where Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe used to sing. Dean Martin, I learned, was a bartender there when he was 17 years old. And the strange thing I learned, too, is that, you know, we think of the mob and we think of Tommy guns. The inventor of the Tommy gun, John Thompson, actually grew up in Newport. So that was something I learned. Food-wise, it's a great mix of the old and the new. You have Baker's Table, which if you haven't been there, you should definitely go.
I mean, that they've been rated like one of the best in the whole country in a lot of publications.
Yeah, and when it opened up, I think it was named Eater. Yeah, it was the top 16 new restaurants in the country when it opened up, and I think it was 2019. But they are just doing really good pasta dishes. They do great breakfast, and they just opened up a new bakery across the street, which is more casual. You can get a great breakfast sandwich there, great loaf of bread. So that's, you know, it's strange because it's across the street from like a Circle K, and, you know, there you have one of the best restaurants and probably one of the best bakeries in town right now.
Are you dissing the Circle K there at 11th and Monmouth Street?
I love that. No, I didn't mean it. I regretted saying that as soon as it came out of my mouth.
It's very convenient, but it is worthy of scorn. Okay, it's totally fair. It's totally fair. I was going to reference, you know, I've done some shows with Falcon Theater on Monmouth Street, and you've got La Mexicana here on your list. And honestly, that Circle K and La Mexicana play a big role in my life when I'm doing a show at Falcon Theater. So I know the area well. Don't worry about it.
speaking of La Mexicana, one of my favorite Mexican restaurants in the greater Cincinnati. I wrote about the pozole, which is just one of my favorite stews. It's just a traditional Mexican stew that's made with hominy and usually shredded pork. They serve a great version of it there. And I just like the whole vibe of that place. It just feels like you're on vacation as soon as you walk in there. But the food is, I hate using the word authentic, but that's the word that's tossed around about La Mexicana. It's some of the more authentic Mexican food you're going to find around here. And it's very laid back. I love... Strangely enough, I'm more of a burrito guy than a taco guy, but they have really great burritos and tacos there.
And margaritas, and they are dangerous margaritas.
Yeah. Of course, the margaritas. Yes, that is definitely a big draw there. I've not had a margarita there because I only go during work hours. So I try to behave myself.
Sure, that's fair. Totally fair.
Yeah, mostly. But there's also this great, the Cookie Jar Bakery. I don't know. Have you been there?
Yes.
It's just such a throwback to, you know, the bakery your grandmother would take you to, you know, this very 1950s kind of place. There's a woman named Sue that was working there, very sweet. And I got the tea ring and took it home, and my daughter and I enjoyed that. But it's just you walk in and you can just kind of feel the history of the neighborhood as soon as you get in there. That it was opened, gosh, in 1903, I believe. No, I take that back, 1927 by immigrant from Nuremberg, Germany. And it is still in the same family, believe it or not.
Wow.
And gosh, what else?
Well, no, you've got the pizza. You know, you can always go to, you know, there are so many great pizza places all over the Cincinnati area, and it seems like new ones continue to arrive. And I don't think you can have too many of them, but Mama Street has one.
Two, actually. There's Pasquale's, which is great. They also have hoagies and things like that. I usually get the hoagie there.
Yeah.
They have like a Stromboli sandwich, which I really like. But Newport Pizza Company is the one I frequent the most. I always thought it had been around for about 100 years. That's what it feels like when you walk in there. But it opened in 2009, maybe. But it reminds me of the pizza parlor my dad just took me to when I was a little kid in Massachusetts. It's just always a great place to sit. I eat alone a lot, so I just like to sit there and eavesdrop on people's conversations. They also have a great beer list. And the pizza is just this kind of old-fashioned pizza, you know, super cheesy, very kind of a New York style. It's just a great atmosphere and great pizza there.
I think you could have a separate column with what you're overhearing at some of these conversations.
I put them in my notes sometimes, and then I have to judge whether it's ethical or not for me to use them.
Well, last on your list, this little tour of Monmouth Street is Ebert's Meats.
Yeah, I mean, Ebert's is just, every time I go in there, too, it's just, it's always very convivial. There's always just lots of great conversations going on. As soon as I walk in, last time I was in there, I'm not sure if he was the owner, but a gentleman in a bow tie was greeting me from behind the counter, and it just felt just so, like, I don't know, it had this kind of Americana feel to it. But they've been around, gosh, they opened in 1897. Making it the oldest butcher shop in Kentucky. And I'm sure someone will call or email me after this and dispute that. But that is what I've learned, that is the oldest. It was opened by Andrew Ebert in 1897. And again, also still in the same family. So this is a great thing about Monmouth Street, is a lot of these businesses just, they've been around for 100 years or so.
Yeah, they really have.
Kind of the same.
They are.
They're not leading the animals right into the basement of the butcher shop for slaughter, and thank God, anymore.
No, it's a lovely walk up and down Monmouth Street and some cool things to check out. That's Keith Pandolfi's tour of Monmouth Street in Newport. Of course, his food reporting is at the Cincinnati Inquirer or Cincinnati.com. In our last few minutes we've got together, Keith, you wrote a nice long piece about a search for, I guess, beef on weck. And I realized in our news meeting this morning here at WVXU, when I was telling the team, you know, what we've got coming up and that you were coming on to talk about this, that I was wrong. I don't even know what weck is a reference to until I read this article, and it's a reference to bread?
Yeah, it's called the Kemmelwick roll, where you get weck, shortened to weck. And it's essentially a Kaiser roll that has studded with coarse sea salt, coarse salt, and caraway seeds, which just give it this sort of peppery, earthy flavor. It's a sandwich that, as I mentioned in the article, when I went to Ohio State, and this is in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a little pub called Buffalo Wild Wings and Weck on High Street. And my friends and I, my roommates and I, would go there every Tuesday for wing night. And I would always get the weck sandwich, which is just as popular in Buffalo as wings are, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes. So what you do is you take the Kemmelweck roll, you dip the top half of it, the cut side of it, in the jus, and then you pile on a bunch of really rare roast beef and often a lot of horseradish. And it's just a thing of beauty. I don't know why. The Buffalo Wild Wings and Wife is now what we call Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah.
It's an enormous worldwide chain. That's what. But it turns out that where I was going was the first location of it. And unfortunately, they dropped the Weck. They got rid of it. I don't know why. But you can still get it, the sandwich, at the Pony Bar and in over the Rhine. That one of the owners there is from Buffalo. So he has a really nice version of it there. And then there's also a food truck in Florence, and but called Buffalo's Best.
But outside of that, that you can't find this sandwich anywhere? Is that what you're saying?
I can't. I know the governor in Milford did a version of it on Friday as a special, but they used a short rib instead of roast beef. And the thing is, in Buffalo, at the really good places in Buffalo, from what I hear, it is hand-carved. You know, you have someone who's like a roast beef artist, a Weck artist, who is, you know, standing at this, you know, not table side, but in the kitchen, hand-slicing this this roast beef. So it's not, we're not talking like Boar's Head, or we're not talking Arby's. This is like really juicy, fresh roast beef. So yeah, but you can't, I'm hoping this article will convince other chefs to take it on, because it's just one of the best sandwiches. I think Anthony Bourdain called it one of the best, a masterpiece is what he called it.
Yeah, you did include that in this article, and that's what I want to know in our last minute together here, Keith. I mean, I love your writing. I trust your judgment on food. You've written about some places that I've immediately gone out to try, and you're always right. But why is this sandwich so special?
Well, I don't know. When I was growing up, I just say it seems like there were a lot more roast beef sandwiches at the delis and stuff. I don't know. You know, I'm not counting Arby's and all that, but it just has this. It is not our tradition; it's Buffalo's tradition. But you know, if we co-opted wings here, why can't we co-opt the Weck as well? It's also just the freshness of the roast beef, the roll itself, the jus, that you know, you get that piling on of horseradish, just is a fantastic sandwich. But that's all I can say about it, really. Just got to trust my judgment, like you said.
I certainly will, although...
really good.
I mean, your attacks on Circle K and Arby's today, I do feel personally attacked.
I did not attack Circle K. I hate mail.
That's Keith Pandolfi, Cincinnati Inquirer food writer. Always a pleasure to chat with you, Keith. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you got it. I want to let you know that coming up next week, Thursday, in fact, the 21st of October, WVXU, WCET, and the Cincinnati Chamber of Commerce will be hosting a mayoral debate featuring candidates Aftab Pureval and David Mann. We will be broadcasting that here on 91.7 FM. It will be broadcast on Channel 48 WCET as well and streamed on the Chamber's Facebook page. So be sure to tune in for that. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer, Selena Reeder. Assistant producer, Nick Swartzel. Technical director, Josh Elstro. Archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.